captain phrase.
It is my captain phrase. Let's go. That's my phrase. All right. Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of Space Force. I'm your host, Jason Dondro.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Mike Smith. Hello.
And we're here to talk about The Sanctuary, the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery. But first, before we even talk about the show, the biggest news in Star Trek this week is clearly the fact that the Disco cast plays D&D together. If you have not seen this, this has been going around Twitter. It was apparently Blue's idea. Blue Del Barrio, who plays Adira. And they were like, well, you know, we're all like touching base with each other in between seasons 3 and 4. How can we like socialize and keep in contact? And Adira was like, well, we can always play D&D, you know, like, you know, total D&D nerd.
As a joke, yeah.
Yeah, as a joke. But Mary Wiseman, who plays Tilly, of course, well, her husband, she immediately volunteered her husband to be DM. And that's no.
I hate that. As a DM, like, you just want to play, and then someone else in the group is like, hey, you're going to do this job. And you're like, okay.
Well, he was totally in for it. No, her husband, Noah, plays Rin, the Andorian, who we'll talk about a lot today. So now they had three people, but they couldn't get the first meeting together. And so then that's when Anthony Rapp comes in, Stamets. And Stamets is like, Rapp says, look, if I have one talent in the universe, it's getting things to actually happen instead of just talk about them. So he, like, at the end of every weekly chat session, when all the actors get together on Zoom and chat, at the end of every session, for 5 weeks in a row, Anthony Rapp is saying, and we're going to run a D&D game if anybody's interested, right? And finally, they got some volunteers. So Ian Alexander, who plays Gray Tall, is in the group. Emily Coots, who plays Detmer. And they join up with Mary Wiseman and Noah and Blue and Rat, and they have a whole gang. And Noah, the DM, is his first time DMing, and he's running Dragon of Ice Spire Peak, which is the adventure in the Essentials Kit. And I just want to say, smart move, Noah, because that's a great adventure. It's perfect for new players. It's got a bunch of little side quests with a big adventure at the end. It's perfect, like, for a new DM and a bunch of new players who haven't played before, or people who haven't played in 20 years, like Rat. And everyone's got characters. Like, Blue is playing Bink Oathbound, a teenage hat tiefling wizard. Mary Wiseman has got Misha, the Goliath Ranger. Anthony Rapp is playing Grafinus, a half-elf druid. Ian Alexander is playing a wood-elf bard, Vivi. And Emily Coots, is playing a half-elf cleric, Erlia. And I just think this is awesome. Like, it's vindication for me, because I'm constantly gamifying the show. So that's why the show is now gamifying itself.
That is cool.
Yeah, when I saw you post it, I'm like, okay, this is going to be the first 3 minutes of the podcast.
It's only
the first 3 minutes of the podcast.
The vindication of the righteous, people. All right. But let's get to the episode itself. So lots of subplots going on in this episode. The main plot is that Book's planet is being held hostage by the Emerald Chain, the Orion crime syndicate that seems to run things in, for lack of a federation. And we go off to his home planet, and there's a subplot where he meets his brother, who's now apparently running things and holding things together, and they get in a lot of fights, and there's a lot of angst over what are we going to do. And the sword of Damocles that the Orions are holding over this planet is an invasion of these sort of floating parasite creatures that normally live out at the sea, but there's so many of them that they've come on land, and the Orions provide them with some kind of insect repellent. that allows the people of the planet to do their harvest. And but the Orions just don't provide that. And so now the locals have to do whatever the Emerald Chain tells them to do, or else they starve. But in, you know, classic Star Trek fashion, the two estranged brothers get back together again after some fist punching. And with the help of the Enterprise, they solve this problem. With the help of Discovery, they solve this problem. And there's some starship shoot 'em up action as the Orion leader arrives, and we get some and we have to drive them off. Meanwhile, lots of other shit happened. The Giorgio plotline, the Burn mystery origin plotline, the Detmer plotline. Did I say the Giorgio plotline already? Because that was like, okay, the Giorgio plotline. Like everything kind of moved forward. So, Abe, what did you think?
I thought the plotline stuff, the subplot stuff, was a hell of a lot more interesting than the actual core stuff.
I totally agree.
As soon as it opened with Giorgio, I thought, oh, hello, this is going to be good. And then she's like there for 2 minutes and she's brushed off to the side. And you go, oh, crap. And she comes back a couple of times in the episode itself. It's like, oh, this is the episode we're going to dig in deep there and we're going to find out what happened to her. No, we don't. It's like, oh, you're dying now. And you go, why now, after meeting with the mysterious man, all of a sudden you're dying? We were expecting some Section 31 brainwashing. We weren't expecting you to be dying, you know. So no. I don't know what's going on
now. Abe does not get to see the teasers for next week's episode.
No.
Nor do you get to see the excerpted scenes that play after the episode is over. So this is where I have to tell you that we actually learned quite a bit about all this in next episode. Apparently, good. Giorgio's body, because she is both from another time and from another dimension, another universe, her body is trying to go back. Her cells are trying to go back to the dimension, to the universe and time that they're from. But because the mirror universe is now so far apart from our universe, that isn't working, and so she's dying instead.
Okay. Now, again,
if
this was a Next Generation episode, that would mean that next episode would be a Giorgio episode.
Yes.
Next episode would not be a Giorgio episode. Next episode would be, hi, I've got a solution to this, Giorgio. Stand back while I do everything for you. Actually, that's what the episode will be.
The next two episodes, I believe, are two-ponal, and they're written by the showrunners of the Giorgio Section 31 spinoff show.
Oh, really?
So I imagine that you're going to actually get your wish.
I hope so.
That it'll be the main focus of those next two episodes.
I'd be really disappointed if it wasn't. Yeah, exactly.
This episode was actually a book episode. Book is the only character other than Burnham that's allowed to get a spotlight episode in this season.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, he had a lot of sharing the screen time with a lot of subplots, but it was really a book episode. I mean, Burnham didn't do anything in the main plot. She basically just hung out with Book as he negotiated everything, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
She didn't want to touch the dice this episode.
No.
Well, having made that vow, I get it. I get it. Jim, what'd you think? Heavy sigh.
So one of the things that we talked about already is the inclusion of all the subplots. Abe brought this up a few episodes ago, and I am entirely on board with Abe's assessment on that. And instead of getting a subplot for the entire episode that moves forward and has motion like we got in the previous episode with Tilly, we get these subplots that move an inch.
Yeah.
Narratively speaking, in distance, they move an inch. You get the reminder of the plot point, you get the slight development, maybe there's a complication, and it to be continues. Yeah. There's no resolution on any of these subplots.
I do think that it's starting to move towards a resolution. I definitely felt like these last four episodes, like that, you can see that's how they scripted it. It was like, okay, first four, middle four, last four. Mm-hmm. we're now entering the final reel, the third reel of this of this season, and you're going to start seeing these things wrap up.
And it's just, again, my go-to refrain, when it's about character, I'm invested.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to know why Gray is being quiet. I want to know why Gray exists, and then this other complication of why is he making this decision to be, you know, to have his space. I want to figure out what Joe is experiencing with Sand, and I have a theory that contradicts my previous theory, but we can get to that. We can unpack that later. But when it came to the main plot, Discovery is allergic to exposition.
That's a good way to put it. Yes. Yeah.
And we get enough exposition to set up whatever the main conflict is of the plot, but I don't know any of the details to become invested in the plot.
Yeah.
So we go through this whole episode and we meet these two brothers played by racially different actors, both of whom have drastically different speech patterns of speech. They're not written to sound like they're the same person.
Sure.
And we're told that they're brothers and they act like brothers, and I'm totally on board for that. But we don't get enough exposition. Are they the only two empaths on the planet? Are all the people empaths and they were the only two in the area that wasn't conscious? Like, I don't know what the ramifications of the setup is in terms of how these people stack in their society. Like, do they discover an empath and that gets related to the royal family? Like, I want to know these things, and I'm not being given opportunities to learn or discover anything new. We're just told enough to get the plot moving.
Yeah, the world builders in all of us want to see, like, yeah, I totally get that. And I'm like, if I'm thinking of, like, you know, if I'm running a Star Trek Adventures game and somebody says, I want to play an empath-like Book, that's an obvious character. Like, let's do that. Now, compare this to the monks, the Romulan monks, the Absolute Candor Gang, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in that episode, we got enough about those monks that if somebody wanted to play one, they had enough, right? Like, they had enough to bite into, and we knew enough about their background. And that show, Picard, wasn't afraid to give us a little bit of exposition. But yeah, in this show, it's like, okay, we're going to show you this empath, and he's going to get to use his powers, but we're not going to tell anything about how he gets them or what his role is in society or anything like that.
Exactly, yeah. We got no, theoretically, he's not – it's not a racial trait. It's a uniqueness, at least to a certain number. Yeah. But then his brother's got it, because otherwise, if everyone had it, it's like, oh, just get Bob to do the thing then. We don't need Book. Why is he here for? So it's just like, there's nothing. Oh my God, thank God, Book, you're the only one that can talk to the animals. Nothing like that at all. Yeah, very weird. Yeah. And also, then his brother can do it anyway. So, you know.
The most interesting thing that Bonham has to offer in the episode is, as her role of observer, is she comments, you know, you guys are empathic and you have no empathy for each other and you're supposed to be.
That's a good
whole episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it was really, like you say, it's a Book episode, Book gets the lion's share of attention because he's most instrumental to the plot.
Yeah.
But it's not an exploration of Book or why he left. Like,
that's true.
None of those issues are brought up.
Yeah, he just gets to do the most stuff is all that I get.
Well, even even it's kind of like, oh, I left because I needed to work because of Curia. It's like, right, okay, and then what? And it's like, well, nothing. I just went, and that was it. It's like, okay, right. There's no feeling, yeah.
We don't think about Picard, where, like, when we went to the android planet, for example, like, we learned kind of how these people lived. In 10 minutes, we saw them walking around their little town or whatever, and we understood kind of what their life was like. We have no idea what life is like on this planet. We know they must farm because he talks about how we can't bring in a harvest. But as Aid frequently comments, we never see anybody doing that. Like, it's a planet with this huge civilization on it that
don't get me started on that part of it. I mean, geez. Again, yeah, minimal amount of people in the background. No overhead shots of any settlements or anything like that. We see inside a couple of buildings, that's it. The idea that this threat is global enough that it's gonna, they're gonna eat every single thing on the planet. And you go, what? Why is that? And but Book and his brother can psychically send them all back in the sea across the entire planet. It's, oh, come on. This is just, it's just getting silly. They I don't get, I don't think they understand the scope of kind of like planetary stuff. The idea of it was like a small colony on a planet, okay, fine. On the entire planet, and you're telling me that someone else on the other side of the world is not working on exactly the same problem with no communication, going, well, I solved it 2 weeks ago. What are you doing this for? It's just like, it's such a weird, there's no, and it, she turns up the spaceship and it's hovering over exactly the right space to shoot down. You know, it's like picking someone in France and going, well, I can spot them from space. There's no problem at all. It's just the insanity of it.
Now, to be fair, like that kind of plot stuff, that doesn't really bother me. It's about the drama and the fact that the discovery can be like, okay, well, the two of you together couldn't do it, but we're gonna, you know, reroute the deflector dish or whatever they're gonna do. You know, we're gonna techno babble it so that we can multiply your telepathic waves on a planetary scale. Like, okay, it's the 32nd century. I'm fine with that.
That's just like I'm with you on that, Jason. Like, the resolution wasn't the issue I had. It was the setup.
Yeah, it's, I totally agree.
But the idea of the magnifying the signal via the discovery,
yeah,
that's just busy work for them to be actually seem to be doing something. if you skip that line, they just sit there and watch it happen. There's no reason for them to be there at all.
I actually liked, though, the way that was handled, because what I thought was going to happen is that Discovery would just fix it. Like, oh, here, we'll just make up some more of these deterrent things. We'll make you a bug spray or whatever. And now you don't need the Orions. And I didn't. But when they had the solution actually be the brothers solving the problem with Discovery just kind of helping on the assist, I liked that better. And I thought that was a better plot resolution.
So the thing that we know about Book is when it comes to animals, it's some sort of empathy, you know. And he's not directing them. He's not Aquaman. He's not telling the whale to smash the submarine. No. He's asking them to do it. Right?
He is Aquaman, because that's exactly how Aquaman works. He does ask. He doesn't tell. Like, this is a big deal in Peter David's Aquaman run, right?
It is. Normally, yes. But the way it's portrayed in most comics, he is the king of Atlantis directing a subject to do something.
It's
a top-down thing.
Okay, all right. It's authority.
Remember, he lost his kingship in that run, and he had lost his hand, and he had to build himself up.
Okay.
So it's egalitarian.
All right, we've down the rabbit hole for all the audience. I had to come to my man Aquaman's defense, but go on about your point.
So he makes a point in this episode. I can only ask to move away. I can't direct them. That's not the way this works.
It's a consent.
The transform swallowed Bonham whole.
Yeah.
He asked her, I think Molly was her name.
Yeah.
Don't eat her. She's good. She's friend. And then Molly spat her up. Well, if this was any other show that called Star Trek, there would be 13 minutes at the end of this 47-minute episode. And they find out that the sea life are leaving the ocean because of X. And if you can help us out with X.
Yes.
It'd be a conversation. We would find out what these creatures wanted. And then the society would be on a hold that they can now communicate with this other form of intelligent life.
Even if it's only on we can supply you with this to stop us doing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it was just like, well, why bring up this idea of empathy if you're not going to explore being empathetic with the creatures that are actually threatening the sapient life on this home world?
What this reminds me of is the same conversation you guys had about the predatory ice.
Yeah.
So the ice planet. You were like, is the ice alive? Is it an alien thing? If it's alive and it's eating people, why can't we talk to it? Which is the Star Trek way, right? Like, the Star Trek solution is to talk to the alien and find a way to resolve this. But because it's Discovery, we have to zip in with a tractor beam and pull you out and make it into an action scene.
This is the thing.
Or we do Star Wars with Detmol flying the ship.
Yeah. This is the thing, though, with these ocean locusts. It's like, right, so theoretically, I mean, again, we're not explicitly stated that they have intelligence, so we can assume they have insect-like intelligence. They're coming out just to roam around, right? Yeah. So him to go, oh, okay, right, can I ask them to do what they do? And they go, no, we're not going to move. Oh, well, we're screwed then. Thanks very much. I mean, it's just like just the idea of, like, okay, that seems to be so... Okay, you can understand why he's trying to do it, but what if they just said no? And again, if were just saying, if there was a solution, like, well, they say they've come on land because they've been driven out, then we can do something about it. And there's a reason for doing so. Well, we can help you with that. There's a reason. But this idea of saying, oh, we asked them and they said no. Well, carry on. You know, it just seems there's always that little missing piece.
But now if we had that plot line, that would have taken all the subplot time, right? So we would have had to cut most of the B plots to have that 13-minute segment where we solve the flailing locust problem.
And that would have strengthened the episode. Like, the idea that we are constantly cutting to these subplots doesn't make it exciting, because these subplots are only advancing by an inch.
Right.
They're only giving us a little bit of time to full setup and complication and possible cliffhanger and or resolution.
Yeah.
That nothing's allowed to breathe because everything's fighting for time and Discovery.
We see Giorgio's body deform and we find out she's dying. That's the plot point that we got from that episode. Detmer appears to overcome her crisis of faith in her own abilities when she...
More to be towards that rather than any kind of PTSD. Just seems to be, I'm not good enough to do this. And then she's flying like, oh, great. So that seems to have literally knocked that on the head. Yeah.
This is something that Jim and I were talking about before the episode started, that the show is not clearly communicating to us what the problem is. And I remember when episode two happened and Detmer hit her head on the console, and I put all my money on a technical malfunction in her implant. And you guys were like, well, maybe it's control. Maybe she got, maybe she got code downloaded into her head and there's a bunch of possibilities. And it turns out all of that was just sound and fury. And it was nothing more complicated than I almost fucked up and now I don't have confidence in my own abilities anymore.
Which again, could have been resolved in an episode where she just talks to the co-pilot for 5 minutes.
And it's a great plot. Like, I would have loved that plot, but I didn't realize that was the plot that we had. Like, they're so busy trying to shell game everything and keep you guessing every episode. I think they're doing it a little bit too much because I don't know.
Discovery is a giant blender.
Yeah.
And it's got this thing called Star Trek, and Star Trek is thrown into the blender. That's the main ingredient. Like, that's most of what it is, right? Yeah. 75% of it's Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you're like, well, we can't just have a 75% show. We have to be how is this show different from the other Star Treks?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to throw in 15% Bonham. So we got 15%, not captain, lead character.
Right.
Now we restructure the whole show around not captain, lead character.
Yeah.
Which is ambitious. Yeah. And then we're like, well, that gets us, we got 10% left. What are we going to throw in there? Well, we're going to make it an action show so that we can get the Star Wars, kind of crowd, the people who like the explosions, and we'll make it a mystery show, and that'll satisfy the Trekkies.
Yeah.
And so all the time we're watching the show, I'm not so much consuming the episode as it is I'm trying to figure out the mystery plot.
Yeah.
Like, what clues are you going to give me to move the mystery plot? Whatever the mystery plot is. And this season, we have like 3 or 4 different mystery plots all happening simultaneously.
I totally agree that of all the different Star Trek shows that there now are, and they're each appealing to different audiences, this is the show that's aimed at the cinematic Star Trek fan, at the I can't even forgotten the name of the alternate universe. What are we calling it? The Kelvin universe. Like this is the J.J. Abrams Kelvin universe Star Trek show. Now they're trying to fix a lot of the things that I think they felt justifiably were bad about that, about those films. So there's still, 75% Star Trek, like you say, Jim. But there is a lot of cinematic kind of special effects, starship action, going on here. We touched on a couple of subplots already. Adira and Stamets have a couple of scenes in this episode. The first of which is notable because we finally clear up Adira's pronouns.
This is what's pissed me off about this.
Go ahead, Ed. Yeah,
this has annoyed me, right? Yeah. Why are we doing this five episodes into her introduction? Or their introduction, sorry. See, there you go. I got called that straight away. There you go. Right. So, because we've had Stamets corner her the entire time, never been corrected.
Yeah.
And then they say, okay, well, I prefer it this way. Now, theoretically, the way they say it is because about only Gray knew about it. So theoretically, this is something that happened beforehand. This is not a Trill made me gay subplot that we were worried about it was going to go down last time, which is almost like you see the setup for, here we go, straight away, we're going to get that.
Yep.
But why, when they stepped on board, did they just not correct when they got introduced on the Earth Force episode?
Yeah.
There was no reason for this. It wasn't a reason to keep a secret. This is not a modern day drama thing where you find out the next door, your daughter now wants to be called they rather than, this is not the problem. And also, we're also not in modern day. We are now in the 32nd century, whatever it is.
Yeah. So
theoretically, this thing shouldn't be an issue. And obviously, to Stamets, it isn't an issue. But by having four episodes where, I'm not going to tell anybody about it, made it an issue.
That made it the issue.
Which is just so weird. I don't know why they just didn't do it from day one.
Well, and you had an observation in the outline that you felt now it makes the audience into the bad guy because we've been misnaming Adira all this time, and now we feel bad about it.
But following mostly Stamets's, his lead, because that's what they said. And like I said, the idea that they couldn't play a female character because acting, you're allowed to play somebody different than yourself. We kind of accepted that as the thing that was happening. But this was then introduced, and you go, why did that not happen from day one then? That makes no sense.
Jim? I have a different read on this situation.
Okay.
I don't mind that it took us a few episodes to get to this moment.
Yeah.
I don't mind that this 16-year-old girl, the 16-year-old Paulson.
It's so easy to slip up.
Well, that's fine because there's no malice attached to it.
There isn't, and there's no malice to my. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know, but it just makes it so infuriating.
The fact that there was this 16-year-old Paulson who was coming into their own, and just told their superior essentially, "Hey, this is how I want to be called. These are the pronouns I want to use."
Yeah,
I don't mind that as part of the continuity because that is something that every people in the modern day world are struggling with.
Yeah,
to see it actually happen and to actually be an example of they are not attacking Stamets.
Yeah,
it's not, they're not. It's
an adversarial conversation. Right. It is a hey, this is my preference, and what is Stamets' reaction to it?
He just nods.
Acceptance.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Complete acceptance.
Yeah.
So it shows people how it's quote-unquote supposed to work.
Yeah.
People can take that as example. My problem with it is I still don't think we've gotten – all right, let me backtrack a little. I'm going to invoke the name of the devil, and I'm sorry. Stephen Moffat. He was the showrunner of Doctor Who.
Okay.
The showrunner of Doctor Who during Brexit time. And there was a lot of conversation about whether or not the Doctor should be female or black. And he made a comment where he said, Doctor Who is for the people, is for everyone. It's for the people who voted for Brexit. Just the same as the people who voted against Brexit.
Okay.
And his thought was, I'm not, again, not defending Stephen Moffat because I think he has other problems. But his thought was, these global properties have to talk to everyone at every sort of level of development. And I think when it comes to this plot point, though a little too subtle, I think it needed another line to verify that, hey, I told Gray this when Gray was alive and I didn't have the symbiont in me, because now we're still dealing, like, if I am a conservative watching Star Trek, I'd be like, oh, okay, they, because they have multiple lives inside them.
Yeah.
And that's what's moving the plot point along, because I've seen Hulk talk to Gray post Gray's death.
Right.
So the reason why the silly aliens, Loki and Bela, from the original series are white on one side and black on the other side is because they're playing to the most conservative pieces of the party and being like, okay, we're going to have a conversation about race and we're going to be really blatantly obvious about it because this is a conversation about race.
Yeah.
I think Discovery needs to be blatantly honest with it because it's not just talking to people who are sympathetic and who are allies, but the people who are watching Star Trek because they want to see explosions or because they've always watched Star Trek and they're not, you know, they're like my parents, they're Republican. Like the more obvious you can make a metaphor for the, you know, you're because you're talking to everyone. So the more obvious you make it, I think it's stronger for the society to get to the point where we don't have to make this an issue 30, 40, 50 years from now.
Yeah.
But right now we might have to because we're talking to people at different levels of education. And
the interesting thing about this is as well is you're in a situation here with this where you have the reality of 32nd century Earth, where theoretically this thing shouldn't be an issue versus it being a TV show in now.
Yeah.
So instead of going like, oh, I want to be addressed as a, well, okay, that's fine. You know, and kind of being inclusive in that way, but saying, well, this time it's not a problem. To going, okay, we're going to make this a thing to do as like almost like you're saying, almost like a, well, you know, there's no big deal about it because we're kind of doing our public service announcement part of the show.
Yeah.
It's such a weird thing to do because I can see why they are doing it. And again, this is kind of where you get the problem with that people don't like a lot of the stuff because they feel they're being hit over the head with it.
Yeah.
And this could have been an opportunity. It's such a difficult thing to just say, okay, this is a non-binary character in 32nd century. It's not an issue because they are. You're one of the people. You identify yourself as that. Job done. You know, that's it.
So,
but we still have to be making a TV series. So you see,
So my take on the scene was a little bit somewhat similar to the two of you, but different also. I totally agree with Jim in the sense that this is an allegory. It's a metaphor and it's a teaching moment for the audience. And so when Adira, it's kind of a coming out moment for Adira, right? To tell somebody other than their partner that they're non-binary. Or identify as with they pronouns, and I totally believed that they were reluctant to say that, and the reason why we didn't see it in the last four episodes is because the character was afraid to say anything, and the fact that they are afraid to say anything tells me that it is still an issue in the 32nd century. The fact that they were afraid to say something to their boss means that the 32nd century hasn't advanced as much as we'd all like to wish that it has. That's what the universe tells me from that scene.
Well, that's right. Exactly. That's what the in TV series lore would seem to suggest. Because it's like, well, if it's an issue and you're making an issue, that's the thing. Again, I don't want to say too much about it in what, because I know as much as I know, which is virtually nothing, you know. And but the actor is non-binary, so hopefully they have had some input to this to say, right, this is how I'd like it to be handled.
Yeah.
Because the idea that they're standing there going, well, this is horseshit, why are they not doing it the way I said it?
Right.
And it's just like, you don't want that to be, you know, you don't want to in 5 years time saying, well, my character on Discovery, complete waste of time because they didn't do the way it should have been done.
You know, compare this, for example, to the Dumbledore thing in Harry Potter, right? Where we find out that Dumbledore is gay after the last book is over and the movies are over and there's no evidence that the character was ever gay. And it's just a complete thought experiment, right? Like, you know, like there, it's a complete waste of time, as opposed to seeing it happen in the show where the character, I've got colleagues in my office who struggled with their own gender identity and they've gone through different pronouns. It seems like, you know, every few months they get a little bit closer to the pronoun that they're actually most comfortable with. And it's a process, you know, and I found it very interesting and I like this scene. I thought that it was an opportunity, like you guys both have noted, it's an opportunity to show the audience, the viewing audience, how we can relate to people in this situation. Like, let's all be like Stamets, right? Let's all smile and think to our, and have that expression. He's so good at this, at that, well, okay then. That's what we'll do. That kind of silent smile expression that he's got. And I thought it was very instructive. Anyway, big social justice warrior moment on Star Trek. The plot had a couple of other points there, though, with that whole sequence. We also had the plot point of that was the burn issue. They set up this algorithm that's one of the many running jokes of this episode that finally pays off at the end, with us discovering that the burn originated in this nebula or something, this interstellar event. And there is a Federation starship trapped in that thing. And this signal from that starship is the source of the musical tone that every civilization knows about, but can't identify. A little skeptical Herm from I'm thinking about this as a Jim. Maybe you can correct me on that. I don't know what you think, but okay, you have a Federation starship that's the source of the burn. It can't just be an ordinary Federation starship, right? Like if we just invent a new starship, it's the USS blankety blank. All the rest of us are going to be like, wah, wah, sad trombone noise, right? It's got to be like, it's going to have to be a starship that we recognize. If it's going to be the source of the burn, and we spent 11 episodes finding the source of the burn, and it's a Federation starship, it's got to be a Federation starship we know, doesn't it?
Yeah. So this is sort of the interesting thought experiment, right?
Yeah.
So I've got a couple ideas because
okay. That's my idea. Yes.
You can do it. It has to be a starship that the audience of Discovery care about.
Yeah.
Or it has to be a person the audience cares about.
It could just be a cat. And
it can't be the mom because the mom's already been established.
Yep.
She's already
can't be mom.
So not mom. It can't be mom. It could be Prime Universe Young Walker.
It could be.
It could be like that could be it. And
we've been told that the mirror universe hasn't crossed over in 500 years, right? Will it fit?
According to the knowledge base that Kovacs. According to maybe this was like the last exodus out of the mirror universe, and that's he's submitting a Starfleet signal because that's what he knows.
Okay, so it could be you can get
Jason Isaacs back. and this is the really weird one, you establish it's some other character the audience is invested in.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the audience of Discovery. Maybe it's the audience of Star Trek. Instead, it can be anything from like Jordy LaForge's starship in Timeless.
Yeah.
It could be Will Riker, and he needs to be saved in the last episode. And we just continue this track record.
The universe is not good enough to give me the Will Riker episode.
So it all, and this is my wild out of the box thinking. It's the Kelvin Enterprise.
Ah.
Because in that scene, they give us a line that Kovacs knows about the Kelvin timeline being an incursion from the Romulan mining ship, the Narada.
The scene Jim is talking about, Aid, is from, we've seen a scene from next episode.
Yes, I've seen this online. Someone mentioned this. Okay. Like, well, did I miss that? And it's like, okay.
Okay, yeah. So you think it's something from the Kelvin universe, maybe even the Kelvin Enterprise, huh?
Maybe even the Kelvin Enterprise, because Viacom, like, this is where the politics of corporations come into play. The reason why the universes were separate was, yep, A, to give J.J. Abrams a blank slate that he could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
But then the corporate reason that occurred around the time of Beyond is that there was the split. So Viacom and Paramount went, separated, and CBS got everything that was TV Trek. And we actually haven't gotten a reference to Kelvin Trek except this episode. This episode references the prisoner code that Ren is protected under, which is the code that Kelvin Kulk puts in his little log that when Spock beams him down on that Delta Vega planet, he complains about that same prisoner code.
No shit.
Yep, that's the best reference.
This episode refers to Star Trek 2009.
Yep. So this is the first time that something new has been introduced in Star Trek from Kelvin to show up here.
Now, Abe, do you have an idea what starship this is? This could be.
Okay, so. The idea that it is a starship. Okay, fine. That's okay. The idea that no one else has discovered this in the past 150 years, apart from the Discovery, because we're super cool, that is a bit annoying. And I mentioned before, the idea that on the original Starfleet base, they couldn't scan outside of a certain sector, and now Discovery can scan across the universe and receive a signal, and they can decode it without the subspace relays and all that kind of stuff going on, unless they literally, there's five parked around the corner from the space where the starship is, and they can actually, it's lucky it was there. As when you were talking about your theories, my theory immediately jumped into my head was, it's the Calypso Discovery.
That's what I thought it was.
That's what I thought. Because then it sat there for 1,000 years, and it's like, okay, went back in time, and it did something, and da-da-da, and that's it. So that's the only thing I can think of.
It's like an alternate Discovery, right?
Yeah.
Like somehow when Discovery went through time, they created some kind of fracture in the timeline, and there's two Discoveries, and one of them is the Calypso Discovery, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the theory I'm going with.
Okay.
But I was also like, how can we have fun with this?
Yeah.
How can we have fun with this? Like, if I have an unlimited budget and they just told me I have all the toys in the toy chest, mm-hmm, I'm gonna get myself some Chris Pine Captain Kulk.
What I'm actually waiting for is for Zachary Quinto Spock to show up. Right.
Which is doable, yeah.
Because I mean, if we're gonna have Burnham and she's Spock's brother, we gotta have the Crisis of Infinite Spocks.
Right? But this is the thing. We've said this many a time before that between us, we can come up with these solutions that would fit in canon with this stuff, da, 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 and then never go that way. I think if they are obviously, we mentioned obviously with the idea that when Spock was revealed to have disappeared, they didn't mention anything about Kelvinverse, which they could have name dropped. If they're name dropping stuff from the actual Kelvinverse, there is a possibility it might be something to do with it. And considering it would kind of follow that through line of what happened to Spock afterwards, that would also kind of give some reference. Someone even said there was a reference to the Kelvinverse in that episode, but I didn't catch it.
I have to confess, I don't really understand how the Calypso Discovery could be
fits in. Yeah,
I don't really get that.
Is there a mirror universe Calypso,
Jim?
Because theoretically, there should be.
What gives Aid credence is, again, looking at what the showrunners have said. The showrunners are giant fans of Voyager.
Okay.
And we've even commented, like, this is Voyager done better.
Okay.
I don't necessarily think it's done good, but it's done better. That was my shot across the bow. And in Voyager, like the second episode, we're going to go rescue this ship that's caught in this nebula that's also a black hole that winds up being, we're going to rescue these people, and it's actually the Voyager that's right outside the event horizon, and there was a time dilation thing. And this is the second episode, Parallax, of Voyager.
So I did Parallax, yeah, of course.
I watched it.
The idea of Voyager, of Discovery, meaning Discovery, is very much in the lexicon of someone who's a fan of Voyager.
Interesting.
So I think they may be trying to do that in a better way, because what's the one other ship that we actually care about the most on this show is the Discovery.
Yeah, yeah.
And even, you know, we got to see some of it today. Like, we haven't seen all the tricked out features. We've seen the medical bay is all nice. But honestly, I'm just like, I'm uncomfortable in this new Discovery. Like, the previous Discovery, I was fine with.
Well, it also struck to me that this might be a way to, this might resolve why Calypso Discovery doesn't look like the new Discovery,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if we've been presuming that the Calypso Discovery is another 1,000 years in the future, It's in the 42nd century. But if it is, then it shouldn't look like the Discovery from the 23rd century. Do I have the dates right? 22nd.
You do. You're good.
It should have the detached pylons and the extra.
I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, when they show up outside the planet and they just detach, you go, well, what did you do that for? What is the point? What was the point in that?
Well, we haven't seen it be more maneuverable. We get to see all the bells and whistles of what Discovery can do.
I think it's cool. I just want to know. Like, I think it's. all right, so speaking of speculation, how do we think this Giorgio plotline is going to pan out? We know that they've been talking about a Michelle Yeoh Section 31 spinoff series. So I think this undermines the drama a little bit, because we can presume that Giorgio's not going to die unless they're going to kill this version and bring in some other version of Giorgio. They've already done it once, right? Like, why not again? Crisis of Infinite Giorgios. Maybe we should call it the Council of Giorgios. It could be like the Council of Reeds from John Hickman's Fantastic Four run.
I'd be okay with it.
The Council of Giorgios. Yeah, yeah. It occurred to me, because Aid, you very clearly noted, you helped us remember that, listen, this Giorgio is a sociopathic, genocidal killer who eats Kelpians for dinner, literally, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's a terrible protagonist. Like, we should not – that's a terrible protagonist. Maybe we're going to – should we kill her off and bring in a non-evil version of Giorgio to be our protagonist?
Maybe the Section 31 show is – sending her back to the Mirror Universe for some kind of plot point, and she's doing something in the Mirror Universe or something. I mean, at least that would be a reason how she could survive if she has to go back, and also give her a show to run around the Mirror Universe in, which I still don't believe they have not done a Mirror Universe show yet. Yep. You know, it'll be violently dangerous compared to every other TV show, but yeah. It'll be, yeah.
Jim, what do you think?
I think Kovacs pointed out the out.
Go ahead.
Kovacs in the episode while he's interviewing Giorgio has said that there's a biological reason she is predisposed towards evil. We have a biological reason. We also have a character whose biology is failing them. And we have already seen someone be trapped in a transporter beam.
Yeah.
In this show, in this season, being phasing in and out of reality.
Yeah.
I think what's going to happen is they're going to rewrite whole DNA, and the Giorgio that we get at the end of the season is closer to the Giorgio that we had in episodes 1 and 2.
They're gonna edit out her evil DNA.
I think that's gonna be the solution.
That is some crazy shit.
Sounds like an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Like, oh my god, I need the earliest evil creature on earth is man. It's like this. Oh, okay.
Well, yes. It reminds me of nothing so much as the famous old original series episode with Good and Evil Kirk, right? Like, the point of that episode was that Kirk needed both halves of himself. He needed the aggression so that he could be a good captain, but he also needed the wise, cautious diplomacy part, right?
Yeah.
Here, it's you've got good Giorgio and evil Giorgio, and we're gonna edit out all of your evil parts. And I don't know.
Again, if they do keep her in, and she is gonna be a star of the show, I really don't want her to lose her snarkiness. I mean, to be honest, that's the thing that makes Giorgio Giorgio, this version of Giorgio anyway.
It's her own character.
Yeah, exactly. She doesn't have to be evil, you know, lawful evil or whatever in alignment. But the idea is she could be, you know, chaotic good, but was still snarky, I think has to be a thing.
Jim, we cut you off there?
No. I also think that, again, returning to the show's love of Voyager.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, we saw Voyager for 3 minutes. We had a conversation about that same starship.
Oh, true, yeah.
Like I can't stress the fact that this is essentially Voyager, you know, done better. I think what Giorgio is experiencing with the mind is there was an episode of Voyager flashback where Tuvok is suffering from a degenerative cognitive disease,
yeah,
and a virus that's forcing him to relive a fake memory. And he goes back in time in the mind space to when he was ensign on the Excelsior underneath Sulu, right?
Yeah.
It was the 25th anniversary episode.
Yes.
The way the virus worked was it kept forcing you to relive a painful memory, and that's how it would propagate. And then it would shift from host to host to host.
I see.
And so I think that Giorgio, because the my tip-off point for that is they specifically say an insulevogram, and that was the scan that the doctor does on Tuvok in flashback.
Wow, that's a deep cut.
That's a deep cut because it was, and the only reason I picked it up is because I see it on the TV because I have my captions on.
Oh yeah.
So I'm like, okay, that's this thing over here.
That's a name check, yeah, yeah.
Maybe it's an evolution of that. So maybe my theory of this is conspiracy, and I want to talk about the Federation before we end up the show.
Okay.
Maybe my thought of the conspiracy being the parasites taking over the Federation, maybe that's off basis because we saw the scan and there was no creature on the neck.
Right? Yep, that's right. That's right.
Like, okay, so that's out. But maybe it's this other thing from Voyager that, you know, gave us Sulu and could give us something awesome too.
Now, there were repeated mentions in this episode that the Federation should not be trusted. We got that from lots of people on the planet. We got it from Rin. And Tilly's like, what do you mean the Federation can't be trusted? And he's like, look, your bosses are not who you think they are, kind of stuff. Is this what you're thinking of, Jim? Do you think this is a...
So the way Star Trek works, not in terms of like, this is sort of like an organic development that I think is being manufactured now.
Okay.
So the way the various spin-off series has worked is you get to season 3 and you get your big bad. Whoever your big bad is going to be for the show. In Next Generation, you get a Cardassians and you get the Borg.
Sure.
So you're recurring threats for the remainder of the show that aren't leftovers from TOS, all those two new races that show up in season 3. In DS9, you get the Dominion. In Voyager, you get the Borg again, the Redux. So I think the villain of this show moving forward is going to be this Federation, this version of the Federation. Like we've always seen the evil admiral, the corrupt bureaucrat, who, you know, he doesn't care about the rules because the greater good must be sold. I think what the positioning is they're going to position Discovery in the way that Thor Ragnarok was positioned.
Okay.
So we've talked about the colonial traits of the Federation in this podcast, almost like back in the full season when we were talking about Picard and deconstruction.
Sure.
In Thor Ragnarok, their solution to that was they blew up Asgard.
Blew up everything.
Asgard's not a place, it's a people. That place is corrupt. So we're gonna start from scratch and then we're gonna build a better society from what remain, right?
Sure.
And then they meet Thanos and that gets, you know, fucked because, you know, it's Thanos, right? But essentially, that's the message of that movie, was colonialism destroys the colonialists, their children, as well as the people being colonized.
Right, right.
And we've always constantly commented on that, that sort of streak of track being like, we'll explore, we're going out to other places to learn things and to eventually assimilate you into our society.
Right.
Now I think it's going to be, this Federation has done that to the point where they've abused their founding members that they left. Three of the four founding members have been told to us they have left the Federation.
Yeah.
Vulcan and Doria.
We haven't seen Tellarites yet, right?
We haven't seen Tellarites. I kind of love the fact that Tellarites are like the holdouts. That's my headcanon. Like, yeah. Tellarites are so obstinate, they're like, we're not going to give this up.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They are famously stubborn. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Vulcan president told us in the last episode that the incident with the Bourne was the last line in a long string of abuses.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm inclined, I am, because I'm a Star Trek fan, I'm inclined to believe whatever a Vulcan tells me. Right? Sure. Especially when they're presented as a good Vulcan, as opposed to being the Enterprise, you know, we're going to try to manipulate you and control you Vulcans.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sort of like, I will listen to her. I think what we're going to have is by the end of this season, our big bad is not going to be this Orion chain,
Emerald chain
syndicate. Like, she looks like a reject from Wizard of Oz. She's going to get my spore drive.
Okay. Yeah. The Emerald Chain, the Emerald Chain bad guy in this one. I mean, the idea that they can say, "Oh, we'll say a rogue pilot took the ship and shot people," and you go, "What they're going to believe?" Because don't worry about that. That's fine. But the idea she effectively does like the old kind of cartoon style where she kind of shakes her fist at the camera and goes, "I'll get you next time, you and it." It's like, oh my god, yeah, yeah.
And I'm sorry. The way the episode is written is we're opened, you know, we are introduced to this new character. She's been name dropped. She's supposed to be threatening. And she has one scene to prove that she's evil.
Yeah.
And she tries to out Joel Joe.
Right.
Like, you should have made her evil in a different way than Joel Joe is, because you have Joel Joe there being snarky, and you can't top that. You can't top the Empress of the male universe. Like, that's just not, there's no ceiling to that. That is the ceiling.
Her scene to show that she's evil is when she browbeats the brother.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Giorgio's not there for that. So that, like, that's her kick for dog scene.
It's a nephew, isn't it? Is it a nephew?
No, I'm talking about Book's brother.
Oh, Book's brother. Oh, sorry. I thought you meant the Orion lady's evilness, where she feeds the person to the slime.
Yeah, the Orion lady, when she threatens Book's brother, and they have that long conversation where she's like, look, we can do this the nice way, or we can do this the hard way.
Yes.
And she does murder her own nephew, but that's just like a throwaway, like funky.
But that throwaway is that's her one character moment that she can have to tell the audience, I need to be taken seriously.
Right.
She gets that moment, and Cole gets that moment in Star Trek 3. And what does he do? He kills the woman he loves. Because he dared to look at the file.
That's
some fucked up shit. Like, you saw him packing that, and you're like, Cole's a bastard. And he's going to ultimately kill Cole's son. Like,
yeah.
Cole establishes himself as a threat in that movie early on. This is her moment to do that, and it's, she talks to her nephew. Her nephew is kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Like, we went through a whole episode where Joe kept telling us how dumb the nephew was.
Right.
And then the solution is, I'm going to feed you to the transport. Like, I'm not scared by that. Like, at no point did I feel threatened, and I don't think Discovery felt threatened.
Right, right, right.
So I think the thing that's going to be the threat, what's going to get us to, you know, the hope is you part two, if it's not time travel, which I hope it's not, but if it's not time travel, is we have to destroy the remainder of the Federation in order to rebuild it.
It's going to be a false Federation.
Yeah.
Well, we've always seen, as we talked about Insurrection, the idea that the Federation member in that seemed to be just a normal Federation. Like, it was just their stance they took on the planet. It wasn't a Section 31 plot. It was just like, well, this is what we do now.
Yeah.
So the idea that they have kind of moved that into their, well, this is what we do now permanently, he's not a, not a, a kind of jumping the gun, as it were. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and it would set up the Admiral as a recurring villain for season four.
Well, yeah, because what? Yeah, why waste him? He's a good character. Yeah, he's a good actor. So yeah, so, I mean, get him on board, do some more stuff. Yeah.
I see. This is my only qualm with your theory, and I actually kind of like it. Like I would totally get behind that, because if you remember, I wanted to have Discovery building the Federation from scratch all season, and I was kind of disappointed when we didn't get it, when they found the Federation still existing. But the actor who plays the Admiral, and I can't believe I've forgotten his name, he's sold me. Like I know that he's hiding stuff, because whenever we talk about the burn, he quickly changes the topic, right? Like he never answers the question. He's obviously evasive. He clearly knows more than he's been revealing to the crew. But we also see him sending Federation starships off to handle problems. He talks about all the good he's trying to handle in a sincere and competent way. And he sold me as a guy whose heart is in the right place. He's just overcommitting.
The irony being that is, like, we don't see the way the other ships handle the
right.
other situation. So the idea that they're not doing the same, we turn up at planet and go, we're going to help you now, but you do realize you now owe us again. This is what we do for you to keep you going. And if you don't keep doing what we do, then we're not coming back. We don't know if that's happening or not.
That's right.
Jeffrey. And to bring it closer to home, America does invest a lot in humanitarian aid, but that's we true. Also preemptively invade countries.
Yeah. Well, so if this is a classic we're gonna teach you through the model of our power, or through the example of our power, or the power of our example, right?
And also the idea as well is if there is some kind of truth to the idea that the burn is caused by a time traveling discovery. That would also give a good reason why that they've got the Temple Accords, because it's like, well, we're not having it happen again. That would give another good reason. Maybe they knew it was an incursion from another timeline and said, well, okay, well, we're not going to have that happen again because we don't want to lose the rest of the dilithium.
I kind of see the Admiral saying, wait a minute, the burn was caused by Discovery. Okay, you guys are toast. And Discovery's like, whoa, we're gone. we gotta zip out of here, because now the entire Federation is after us.
And I'm not convinced that the temporal cone wall, that the temporal walls are oval.
No.
I think there's still some shenanigans, because again, we commented that know-nothing pirate guy, cowboy guy, knew exactly what time travel was.
Yeah.
Like, why would you know that if for 150 years time travel has been banned?
Well, now that we have speculated all day long on this, we will be back next week as we zero in on the end of this season. We have a two-part Georgiou focused episode, probably going to set up her ongoing series. And she's either going to die or be replaced. We don't know. But it looks like a pretty interesting plot line. I'm eager to see them tie into the Kelvin universe. Thanks to Jim for noting they actually already have in this casual one-off reference to a prison code number. Can't believe you recognize that, man. And we'll be back.
You know what? It, despite its flaws, I've seen 2009 Star Trek a lot, because it is one.
Yeah. We'll be back next week. Thanks, everybody.